And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, where one of the strangest issues to emerge in the campaign for president of 2024 is the issue of rules that have been passed in many states to try to limit the care for transgendered or would-be transgendered students or young people below a certain age. And whatever that age, it's very relevant that there is a new study coming out of Europe that indicates that much as critics have charged about the entire transgendered phase and the entire push to provide transgender care for even very young people, that a big majority of transgendered kids who are followed in a 15-year study concludes that transgenderism is often, and most often in a majority of cases, just a phase for kids. What does that mean, and what's the impact of that study? We will get to that. We will also be talking about Asphalt City, a brutal new film, and it is. It's past some scenes of unforgettable brutality with Sean Penn playing a veteran emergency medical technician, EMT, working for the Fire Department of New York City. We'll also be reviewing a true story from 100 years ago starring Olivia Colman. And she plays a pious, what used to be called a spinster. In real life, this character was 30 years old, which I guess today absolutely would not be a spinster, but she was a very pious lady, well-liked in the community, who started getting these awful letters that were full of obscenity, and the question was, who sent them? We will get to wicked little letters as well. But first up, it is an opportunity for us to honor a Call of the Week classic.
The Call of the Week.
I get so overwhelmed. Like, I don't understand.
It's educational.
Like, everyone goes to the bathroom on campus every day, unless they have some great powers.
It's informative.
Your talk show creates a hostile environment.
Feel the love.
I love Fidel Castro. Fidel Castro, please keep it up.
Hear the hate.
And you're the devil. You're the big Hitler.
Every Friday exclusively on The Michael Medved Show.
And the winner is... The winner is Chris in Auburn, Washington, who provides some interesting and unique insight into the animal kingdom. This is from 2017. The month of April. Chris in Auburn, Washington, you're on the Michael Medved Show.
My comment is on your question of natural selection and being gay.
Mamma mia.
No, it's not being gay, being transgendered.
Hey girls, a real woman is here.
Okay, well I understand that. But I don't think I will answer that question. But I watched a program on Nat Geo Wild and another program on the History Channel called The History of Sex.
I know nothing.
And they did a 15-year study of crows, and they said that 30% of the crows were homosexual.
Devalicious.
They did a study on, 10-year study on, not a study, they did a 10-year study on wolves. And they said that 19% of the wolves had homosexual tendencies.
I'm just flabbergasted by how on the money you are.
So when people say you can't be born that way, are they going to be chased out by natural selection? That's not true.
There is no other way for wolves to reproduce or for crows to reproduce. You cannot reproduce through homosexual sex.
It's science.
But you cannot believe that there is some kind of evolutionary advantage to not reproducing. It just doesn't happen.
30% of the crows were homosexual. 19% of the wolves had homosexual tendencies.
The forest is very lonely for a thing like he.
I'm a gay wolf.
He's a gay wolf.
The creatures of the forest are set in their ways. It's very hard to be an animal gay today.
This is super embarrassing.
Yeah, it is a little bit super embarrassing. I don't really know the context in which Chris was calling in. But the idea being that somehow people are unchanging in their sexual orientation has simply been contradicted by study after study after study after study. And again, it's one of those things that where you look at measures of the way that people identify, it is entirely common and shown that way by all of the most recent surveys of Americans as well, is that younger people are more likely to identify as part of the LGBTQ community. And part of that is because, of course, the attitudes of young people are much more influenced by what is the attitude today, where the disgrace and pain and, yes, oppression that had once been visited on people simply because they were homosexual, that's dissipated. So obviously there is less social pressure, but there's also a recognition that as people age and grow up, some of the statistics indicate that for human beings, let alone wolves and crows, that having a homosexual experience when you're a teenager does not mean that you are gay for the rest of your life, forever. Which is why the of people who identify as LGBTQ, which is estimated to be now about 7% of the population of younger people, but to be part of that population doesn't mean that you are invariably gay the rest of your life. The biggest category among LGBTQ people is people who say they're bisexual. And that seems to me to be something that is quite connected to a new study that is worth talking about. There's a piece in the Daily Mail in Britain about it. And they point out that the majority of gender-confused children grow out of that feeling by the time they are fully grown adults. According to a new long-term study, researchers in the Netherlands tracked more than 2,700 children from age 11 to their mid-20s, asking them every 3 years about their feelings about their gender. Results show that at the start of the research, around 1 in 10, 11%, expressed gender non-contentedness to varying degrees. But by age 25, just 1 in 25, 4%, said they often or sometimes were discontented with their gender. The researchers concluded, quote, "The results of the current study might help adolescents to realize that it is normal to have some doubts about one's identity and one's gender identity during this age period, and that this is also relatively common." It comes amid a conservative boom in transgendered children receiving drugs to change their gender in the U.S., as critics say doctors and patients are not challenging young people enough. Back with more on that, and Bernie Sanders speaking out against Israel, coming up on the Medved Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, coming up on our Substack account, I just did a column related to part of what we were just talking about, which is a new piece of legislation, which we've mentioned on the show, where the public schools in the state of Washington are now going to be required to incorporate into their curricula for middle schools, high schools, and so forth, gay history. Some kind of curriculum learning guides that would include for every school district in the state of Washington, and we're one of seven states with laws like this, information about some of the history and contributions of LGBTQ people. And the difficulty I had is that if you're talking about really trying to find LGBTQ includes transgendered people, transgendered pioneers in the Washington frontier, it's a small group, small. And part of the difficulty here is finding what it is that you're going to actually teach people about. Seattle was known in its very early years after the founding of the city in 1851. It was known for many years as a center of, well, prostitution and booze and gambling. And but those kinds of behaviors may have not been illustrative of the most robust family values, but it was definitely heterosexual in its focus. And one of the things that I think is fascinating is that most people don't realize that King County, which today is Martin Luther King Jr. County, up until 1985, when it was changed by the city government, the county government in King County, Washington. It's a county where Seattle is. Before that, it was named after William Rufus Devane King, who was vice president for about 6 weeks. And he basically had his name attached to the county, together with Franklin Pierce. That's why you have the two largest counties in Washington are Pierce County and King County. Pierce County is where Tacoma is. But in any event, this William Rufus Devane King, and I was looking at this and doing this piece for Substack. It's at Michael Medved Substack. Substack.com. The William Rufus Devane King and his biographers actually look at this situation. He very likely was somebody who was gay. And how do we know? Well, he lived together with another U.S. Senator, James Buchanan, who later became our worst president. But they lived together for 13 years and they had passionate love letters to one another, and Andrew Jackson derided them. He called them Aunt Fancy and Miss Nancy, which was considered to be a high insult at that time, but no duel resulted. In any event, the question about what you teach in gay history classes is very real. Speaking about teaching in classes, one of the things that is remarkable in pop culture is we mentioned that this is the anniversary of the death of Kurt Cobain in 1994. Isn't it amazing that that long ago, April 5th? This is the way that death was announced on MTV by Kurt Loder.
Hi, Kurt Loder with MTV News. Nirvana leader Kurt Cobain, an extraordinarily gifted singer, songwriter, and guitarist, was found dead in Seattle on Friday morning, apparently a suicide. His body was found at a house that he owned but didn't live in anymore on Lake Washington Boulevard. He was discovered by an electrician who was doing some work on the house. He had been killed by a blast to the head from a 12-gauge shotgun, and a suicide note found nearby, according to the electrician who found him, ended with the words, "I love you, I love you, I love you." Nirvana had been struggling with fame and fortune, which came overnight with the release of their album, Nevermind.
Okay, this is, Cobain was part of what has become known as the 27 Club. which refers to celebrities, most of them musicians, who died at the age of 27. That list includes Kurt Cobain, Brian Jones, who was an original member of the Rolling Stones, Jim Morrison of The Doors, singer Amy Winehouse, blues singer and guitarist Robert Johnson, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and many more, including a folk singer named Nick Drake, all from the 27 Club. Somebody who is not 27, he's actually 82, is Senator Bernie Sanders. He had this to say on CNN with Jake Tapper. Clip one.
Secretary of State Blinken today said that if the U.S. does not see changes to protect civilians in Gaza, there, quote, will be changes in our own policy, unquote. Do you believe them? I mean, I feel like we've been hearing this for a while.
Well, I think you make a good point, Jake. Look, the bottom line is we are looking at one of the worst humanitarian disasters that we have seen in a very, very long time. We're literally, at this moment, looking at hundreds of thousands of children starving to death because Israel is not allowing the humanitarian trucks into Gaza, and especially into the areas where people are in most desperate condition. To my mind, Israel should not be getting another nickel in military aid until these policies are fundamentally changed. So if, you know, my view is no more military aid to Israel when children in Gaza are starving.
Okay, again, he says the children in Gaza were starving before the war. I mean, conditions have not been great there, not because of Israel, but because of Hamas, which governs the place. And the question here is not how miserable people are, but why. And that became part of this follow-on conversation with Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont. Clip two.
What do you say to people who say the reason that so many innocent people are dying in Gaza is because Hamas embeds with the Palestinian people? They build tunnels under their homes. They hide under people. They want all the civilian death toll. They consider them martyrs, and it makes Israel look bad.
I think that is perhaps a part of the problem, but it's not the real problem. The real problem right now is we are looking, as I mentioned a moment ago, a massive starvation. That is not caused by Hamas. That is simply caused by Israel not allowing the hundreds and hundreds of trucks that are lined up at the border to get in and go to the areas that it is needed. That is Israel's responsibility, not Hamas's.
Okay, again, in terms of cause, what about October 7th and the start of this war and this emphasis? On a much lighter and brighter note, it's springtime, and people all over the world, but certainly all over the United States, are talking about doing something about their immediate surroundings, gardens, havens. How do you do it? We'll be right back. Okay, it is now April. It is spring season, full bore, here on the Michael Medved Show. And certainly it's a great time, with our spirits warming up, to also warm up and breathe new life into your surroundings, particularly your backyard, to embrace that vibrant spirit of spring. With outdoor trends constantly evolving, essential to stay ahead of the curve when it comes to sprucing up your outdoor space. Most people care about this a lot, but nobody more than Sarah Bendrick, who is a TV personality and a licensed landscape contractor. What is the surprising conclusion you've come to for people who want to make the most of their outdoor surroundings?
Sure. So, yeah, like you said, it's spring and everybody's really excited to get out into their yards. And I wanted to talk about different trends that I see come through. I've worked all over the nation, and these are things that I've kind of gathered that I'm noticing people be excited about. And one of them is bringing bugs. And I know it doesn't sound like most people are like, bring me the bugs. But we're thinking birds and butterflies and other balanced garden insects. So it is really a system. So instead of annihilating everything in your yard, more people are welcoming them in because it creates a healthier garden for you and for the garden itself to thrive.
Well, I know, Sarah, part of what you've written about, and you've written books, best-selling books like Big Impact Landscaping. Part of what you're talking about is why it's important to avoid harmful chemicals and to respect rather than to pursue the insects in your garden.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great way of saying it. Yeah, the harmful chemicals, especially when used heavily, are not very good for the soil, the structure, the soil health, which is ultimately what creates the healthy garden. So if we can try to protect that soil and also have that balance of bugs in the environment. In fact, the soil has many, like worms and stuff like that, that help decompose the material to make it plant food, for lack of better words. And so I think a lot of people are really respecting that relationship that they have. And so avoiding the harmful chemicals is helpful to creating a healthier overall garden.
Wait, you also say something that never occurred to me, but it makes sense when you hear about it, which is that battery-powered tools are a better option than gas-powered tools. Why is that the case?
Sure. So I think there's always going to be a place for gas-powered tools. But I think for most residential homeowners, switching to battery makes a lot of sense for a few reasons. And one of them is low noise. So if you're in a neighborhood, it's not something that's going to be as loud as a gas tool. But also the zero exhaust emissions is a big win with homeowners because it's just a lot easier to deal with. Lightweight, but also the power and performance really is there for battery now. And I think when people start playing around with these tools, they're realizing that. Personally, I use Steel's AK system, which has about 15 different tools, and they all share the same battery. So I can use that one battery in all of the tools, and I'll usually use that one and have another battery on the charger if I need it to, if I have like a big project going on. But most of the time, on one charge, I'm able to complete the tasks that I usually need. So I think it's just a no-brainer for most people who are looking to maintain their spaces and are looking for an easy way to do it.
You also give some advice about avoiding artificial mulch or turf and going instead, as far as you possibly can, for using native plants. Why is that important?
Sure. So native plants bring in some of the beneficial insects into your yard, like the pollinators, which are great, again, creating that balanced yard. And when you use colored mulch, rubber mulch, artificial turf, those things are, well, they're artificial, and so they don't really enhance the landscape in any way. In fact, they can be a little detrimental, adding chemicals to the soil, or as the rubber breaks down, it gets hot, and it's not really feeding anything. So we prefer to lean into organic wood chips or pines or straw or something that will naturally break down and help enhance that soil. And when it comes to artificial turf, I don't like to treat one material as super evil. If you're going to use something like that, it should be used for a very specific area, not just to cover from one end of the yard to the other for low maintenance, because it really kind of collects heat and it doesn't really add to the garden feel, if you know what I mean.
Sarah Bendrick, what's some of the immediate benefit that people get from using this more enlightened approach to your garden and to giving your garden new life?
So I think the biggest thing is we get stuck in these cycles. If you're using a lot of synthetic fertilizers and you're using a lot of sprays and this and that, your plants are generally not going to be as healthy. And so leaning into the organic route where you're feeding the soil and protecting the soil, you are having stronger plants because they're able to pull natural minerals out of the soil. Most of our soils have all the minerals that we need. They just are not always available to our plants. So by having that organic mulch and having that balance of having worms in the soil makes all those nutrients available and creates it helps hold moisture, and it helps create more resilient plants, so they're lower maintenance in the long run.
Okay, where can listeners who may be resonating with this very directly, where can they get some more information and even some more help?
Yeah, sure. If you could check out DIYtipswithsarah.com, and that's S-A-R-A, no H.
DIY, do-it-yourself tips with Sarah, S-A-R-A, and spelled differently if I have a daughter, Sarah. But Sarah Bendrick, who is the author of Big Impact Landscaping and 28 DIY projects you can do on a budget to beautify and add value to your home. Her work is delightful, I imagine, all through the year, but particularly in this wonderful spring season that we are celebrating. People should go to...
It's DIYtipswithsarah.com.
Okay, that's much better. DIYtipswithsarah.com. Appreciate speaking to you, and happy and best wishes for a joyous spring season. On the Medved Show, I wanted to get, before the show draws to its close, to some really remarkable points that were made by Coleman Hughes, who is a very young but very brilliant writer and commentator. He was on a recent episode of the Joe Rogan podcast, making one of the most salient and important points about the war going on in Gaza. Listen.
If you ask the question, what is unique about this war? What is different about this war than all other wars? It's not the civilian death toll. The ratio of combatants to civilians is, I think it's better than the American armies was when we got ISIS out of Mosul. That was like 10,000 civilians dead to kill 4,000 ISIS. This is 19,000 civilians dead to kill 13,000. It's not that... You know, what's unique about this war, unlike every other war that I could think of, is you have an army in Hamas that has perfected the art of embedding itself, enmeshing itself with civilians so that you cannot hit them without hitting the people around them. Other armies have done this, but none have perfected it to the extent that Hamas has. No army that I know of in military history has had 15 years to build 300 miles of tunnel underneath a city that they don't use to shelter the civilians, but they use to shelter themselves so that they can operate right under a kindergarten, right under a mosque. So this is a challenge no army has faced.
And it is a challenge that implicates the United States. As a relief to all of this, there's a bright comedy, true story, and a gripping, hard-hitting, tough film about EMTs in New York City. And wishing everybody a joyous and rewarding and life-enhancing spring weekend. One of the ways that you can do that is take advantage of our one-time-only, once-in-a-lifetime sale for all of the products at the Medved History Store. It gives you the whole Medved History Store library at 85% off. Just 15% of the normal price. Go to michaelmedved.com. This is close to 50 different discrete programs about different questions and aspects of American history. And yes, the history of the Middle East and Israel as well. But check it out. It's never been available at a comparably low price to Michael Medved.com or MedvedHistoryStore.com. be sure to use the promo code MEDHEAD to get this fantastic discount. Meanwhile, we do have other forms of entertainment and maybe even some inspiration coming from Hollywood. Olivia Colman is a wildly and widely respected actress, and she recently won an Oscar, and then she appeared in a film, My Lost Daughter, with Jesse Buckley, and they have teamed again for a new film, which is actually based on a bizarre historical incident. And I had never heard about it. It's called the Little Hampton Libels. And it took place 100 years ago, between 1920 and 1925, in a little seaside picturesque village, really, of Great Britain, in Little Hampton. And Olivia Colman plays a devout older lady who is considered to be a spinster, even though she's supposed to be around 30, and a real person who was very pious, very active in local Christian and church activities. And all of a sudden, she started getting these horrible letters filled with really filthy, disgusting language, and that really is shocking, because that language is the essence of the story. That's why the movie's rated R. In any event, she has a neighbor who is a single mom who actually enjoys having a pint or two. She's immediately fallen under suspicion as the perpetrator of what are called these wicked little letters. That's the name of the film. It sounds like this.
In the end, I think it's just jealousy.
Do you feel certain Rose Gooding's guilty?
I can't see why they think it's me. Some of the verge of making history here.
I was a bit roisterous once or twice.
This time you owned up to these letters.
Rose Gooding allegedly harassed a pretty young Christian woman.
What's the evidence?
Similarities in the language.
I think you've been set up, Rose. Is there anyone who'd want to do such a thing?
Have you got a pen and paper?
I like you, Rose, and I'd like to bring you to the light.
Why would I send a letter when I can just say it?
I'm not standing for it. Will you catch them in the act?
Okay, this is fascinating, because this ended up in three different trials, and the idea that they were willing to arrest and try a woman for allegedly dropping material in a mailbox that is upsetting to other people because it is so it's so disgusting in terms of some of the language and some of the imagery that it conjures up. All of that is fascinating. The film is gorgeous to look at. The recreation of Britain in 1920 is exceptionally well done, and the cast is helped by the parents, the two wonderful British actresses, Gemma Jones and Timothy Spall, who play the parents of the main character. The difficulty is that some of the film is a whodunit, who really sent these letters, but the movie tips itself off very early on. In other words, if you're paying close attention, there are little hints as to who the guilty party really is. However, it is enjoyable to watch, and it is satisfying just to see people creating fairly realistic and sympathetic characters who should be friends, but are at war, as it turns out, over the wicked little letters. It is rated R for some sex references and lots of very tough language, and with much deployment of the F word. 3 stars for Wicked Little Letters. Asphalt City, the other film that we're reviewing, also involves an Oscar winner. This one, Sean Penn, who as he usually does, gives the performance all of his energy and all of his focus and all of his attention and range of emotion. But the real star of the film is actually Ty Sheridan, who is in the film a younger individual who is taking a job with the emergency medical technicians, the paramedics working with the New York City Fire Department. Why? Because he's getting ready to take the MCAT test, the medical school admissions test, because he wants to go to medical school. So he is learning the ropes in a very, very hard-hitting portrayal of what life is like when you're a paramedic rushing to the scene of domestic battering, when you're running to the scene of a gang shootout where people are bleeding to death in front of you, where there are all kinds of inhuman horrors. This is based on a novel by a writer named Shannon Burke. The novel was called Black Flies. and the movie initially was called Black Flies. Now it's called Asphalt City. I think they must have tried some consumer tests and found that trying to get people out to the theater to see a very serious film called Black Flies might be a challenge. Some of the dialogue with appropriate New York accents sounds like this.
How long you been on the job?
A few weeks.
This guy from Colorado, I'm putting him in a rut.
I usually get here 10 minutes early. I like to ride with partners who do too.
Yes, sir.
You think these people like you? You think you're saving people?
They give you about 2 weeks.
I know what you're thinking. Is it worth it?
It's the job. I did what I thought was right.
We start doing this because you want to help people. Sometimes you just end up doing the complete opposite.
What am I doing?
Helping people get better.
I'm worried about you.
You need help.
Get away from me.
We all work in the darkness. You don't gotta let it inside you.
Okay, darkness is inside and outside and everywhere in the film. It's directed and with mostly a very effectively deployed handheld camera by a French director named Jean-Stéphane Sauveur. And there are scenes here, and I see a lot of movies, but there are scenes here that are just so nightmarish and so cruel and so horrible. There's a particular sequence involving a baby born to a heroin overdosing HIV positive mom, and who emerges bathed in blood, and there are scenes that are very, very hard to take. It is rated R, of course, but the characterizations come across, and particularly Sean Penn's characterization, which is really a supporting role, with Ty Sheridan having the main focus as the protagonist. It is one of those films that is very hard to forget some of the scenes, but also very hard to experience them. Rated a very tough R. It's playing in theaters, 2.5 stars